everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on a frozen January 28th, 2014. And we're going to warm you up today because we're going to be talking about soup. And soup is really exciting, and you're going to find out just why that is in a few seconds, okay? I want to bring on my first guest, Mark Reinfeld. He's been on this program a number of times, and he has a new cookbook out. It's called The 30-Minute Vegan Soups On. He is an award-winning chef and author or co-author of six books, including Vegan Fusion World Cuisine, The 30-Minute Vegan, The 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of the East, The 30-Minute Vegan's Taste of Europe, and both Vegetarian Times and Veg News named them to their top cookbooks of 2012 list. He offers culinary trainings and tours worldwide and online at veganfusion.com, and he lives in Hawaii. Mark, welcome back to It's All About Food.
Hey, Karen. It's great to be back.
Thank Are you in Hawaii right now?
I actually just relocated to Miami Beach. So
we'll have to change that bio.
Try it. That just occurred to last week. So
okay.
From tropics to tropics, yeah.
Miami Beach. It's not as warm there.
It's pretty warm here, not to compare with what you guys have up there. But it's
cold for Miami, I bet.
Yes.
Yeah. People get their fur coats out around this time in Miami. And I'm not promoting fur.
They like bundling up.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so you're a little closer by. So there's probably some good business for you down there.
Yes. I just finished actually one of those 10-day training and a teacher training here that I offer around the country, showing people how fun and easy it is to include plants in their diet and lifestyle.
Right. Well, one of the things that I like that you wrote in the very beginning of the book, I'm looking for it here. I should have opened the book and prepared myself for it. But, page 2, Recipes for Peace. And I love what you say, that the time we spend inside the kitchen can serve as a metaphor for life outside the kitchen. Let's just talk about that for a minute, because I'm always telling people to find their kitchen. It's like something we've lost. We don't know how to make our food.
Yeah, I think it's a big step towards healing and taking our health back into our own hands if we can prepare food ourselves. And it's really my passion to show people how easy that can be. And so I do feel like it's the skills that you learn in the kitchen, like being present with what you're doing, especially when you're handling a knife, and just focusing on positive things in your life and being grateful for having access to the food and being able to prepare it. Those qualities really overflow into your life outside of the kitchen.
I know a lot of people feel stressed when they're in the kitchen, and primarily it's because they don't know what they're doing. And just like so many things, if we want to be good at anything, we need to practice. We didn't learn to walk overnight.
That's right, and I really encourage students in my classes to maintain a positive attitude. And I heard a great story about a positive attitude. A friend, close friend, won a handball tournament, and when he got a point, he said, "Good shot," and when he missed the shot, he would say, "Nice try." So that's the idea of good shot, nice try, good shot. You just keep moving forward with that positive attitude, and don't beat yourself up if you miss a recipe ingredient or something like that. There's usually a way to correct it. And like you said, with practice, I feel that all of us can really become amazing chefs.
Well, you don't have to divulge any of your bad stories, but I mean, how many times have you been in the kitchen and things didn't work out quite right, and then you made it into something else?
Right. Like sometimes I would leave out like a small ingredient in baking, like the leavening or something like that, and I would just be left with like a solid mass of chocolate or something, and then you could just cut it up and put it in a parfait glass and make some vegan whipped cream and serve it as a nice parfait.
Right. Now, one of the nice things in this book is you break apart the components of soup And for some of us who've been making soup for a long time, we don't even think that way. We just throw it all in a pot and it happens. But for people that are starting out, it's really good to think about the pieces, because as you mentioned, once you understand all of those pieces, that kind of frees you up to be a little flexible if you don't have one ingredient or another.
Right. I like to call that it's a template, looking at recipes as a template. So by breaking it down like that, and you see, like, there's, like, a main vegetable part, there's a part that would give it creaminess, there's a part that may be an ethnic spice blend, one part could be the stock, and by changing each of those parts, you can create a new recipe. So I really, in the book, there may be 100 or so recipes, but there's really thousands of recipes contained in the book, and I'm promoting it as vegan soups for the chicken soul. So show people just how satisfying it could be to work with fresh vegetables and fruits and grains and nuts and seeds to create these delicious soups.
Okay, once again, we learn that vegan food is not deprivation. It is not boring. And we're just talking about soup right now. And in this one book, there's over 100 versions, and they're all pretty different. So there's lots of variety.
Now, yes, and I also included a section on raw soups, which is the new raw food cuisine is like the cutting edge in the vegan food scene. And so there's a whole section on raw soups that you could have as chilled soups during the summer, also dessert soups. So it's a real broad spectrum of vegan soup preparation.
Now, soup, I don't know. It depends on the culture, of course, but I think in our society, soup gets a bad rap a lot of the time. It's a food that a lot of people relate to what people eat when they're poor, or the, you know, the old-fashioned stories that we hear or see in movies, the poor people adding the water and thinning the soup, and they have, like, one bone and one thing, and... But soup is not a poor food.
Well, I like to, you just brought to mind the idea of a stone soup, which is a funny story about adding stones, of how you can create soups really from anything. And it can be taken to a very high level of gourmet cuisine. And that's something that I really strive for, is for people to have this really world-class, very high-level gourmet experience with meals and recipes that take 30 minutes or less. So that's the underlying idea behind the 30-minute vegan series.
Now, I love soup, and you can see there's so many different kinds in your book. Dr. Furman, for example, who's my favorite medical doctor, is always encouraging people on their basic, simple diet to eat a lot of bean-based soups and salads. And, of course, there are plenty of them in here, and it's really inexpensive, and there's so many different beans and so many different ways you can have a bean-based soup, but so filling and so good for you. Then I remember living in the south of France, and all the soups were served at, like, a puree with some kind of cream base, always in addition to a meal. It was never the whole meal. And then something that always, like, gets me excited are these Vietnamese noodle-based soups, these giant bowls full of all kinds of fun things. And these are completely different soups.
It's a vast spectrum. You can definitely go the full gamut, and some, like, the difference also between a soup and a stew, say, is it's, like, generally a stew would have less liquid content, so you can go from almost, like, a really light broth base soup to just a heartier stew. So I like the idea of just the soup for every season and really every climate. So now with the winter months upon us, like, having those heartier stews and bean soups, like, there's just a world of variety possible.
When I eat in a restaurant, soup is typically something that I don't care to order. And it's mostly because it's full of salt. And some restaurants, it tends to be like a cheap item somehow. Not good ingredients, lots of salt. And I love soup, but I rarely order it in a restaurant.
Well, this will, you can go home after your restaurant experience and make a midnight snack of some of the
soup from the fest. That's right. I can't tell you how many times we've done that. We go out to eat and we come home and say, okay, what are we really going to eat? Oh, yeah. Okay, so you're helping people get over their fear and get into the kitchen and learn how to make many, many wonderful soups. Now, you mentioned the desserts and the raw soups, and I want to talk about those a little bit. I remember first seeing a dessert soup on a restaurant menu, and I had never thought about soup as a dessert. And I have to say, there's something, it doesn't, like, compute to me, and yet I'll have a smoothie or something, which is really a dessert soup, only it's served in a glass instead of a bowl.
Right, and there's different ways you could present. Like, there, one way is you do little, you could even do little, like, shot glasses type soup. So it's more like a liquid dessert. So there's like an almond milk based chocolate soup or a, like a watermelon lime soup that would just have the fruit and fruit juices blended. And we can make like fruit creams using soaked cashews. So it is just that getting that sweet satisfaction at the end of a meal in the form of a soup. So you can have it as a big bowl or just like a little in a little shot glass as like finishing touch on a meal.
Now, I was raw for a couple of years around 2004, 2005, and I did venture into making a number of different raw soups, and I have to say I haven't really made too many since I've gone back to eating some raw and some cooked, and I don't know why that's happened, because especially looking in your book here, there are some really lovely things that I know people can eat year-round, but especially in the warm weather, a raw soup can be
definitely
very nice.
It's, I think it's, there's, my, I feel my niche is like introducing people to the full spectrum of vegan cuisine, from the heavier, like comfort foods like lasagna and enchilada casserole, things like that, all the way into the raw food world, which is usually lighter, and so everyone has their own like optimal percentage, I think, of raw food, so that varies over time and by climate and environment and or the season of life that we're in. So I think just making an effort to include those fresh fruits and vegetables in whatever ratio feels appropriate at that time is a good kind of guiding light with our food choices.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at some of the pictures in the middle of the book, because the middle of the book has all the colored pictures, and they're gorgeous. I want to say that photographing soup, not many people think about this, but it's not an easy thing to do.
Well, food photography in general, for anyone who's tried, if you get 2 or 3 shots out of 100, you feel like you did a good job. So there's a lot of... The photographer actually is this woman, Amaya Green, who did the photography for our first book, the Vegan Fusion World Cuisine book, and she's really gifted. I'm very, very happy with how the photos came out.
Yeah, they're beautiful. The thing about soup is it's really hard to see what's in them, because they're usually in a deep bowl, and with the photography, you need to enhance some of what's in it by putting it on top so we can appreciate what's in it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a challenging thing. Something that I love to do, you have a curried pumpkin soup, and I love filling squashes with food, either stews or soups.
Yes.
It's so festive. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I like getting creative with the presentation. One thing I like emphasizing also is this idea of food as art. So it's just another form of creative expression, and nature provides us with this palette of colors and textures and flavors that we can work with. So usually the meal begins with the eyes, so I like to create a really beautiful visual before people even taste the food.
Now, the broth is challenging, and when people are used to making soup and they're not vegetarian, they usually just reach for a can of chicken broth.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the big flavor in there is salt.
Right. That was it. That posed an interesting challenge because in developing the recipes, I want people to be able to follow the recipe and have it turn out amazing. So adding a stock really enhances the flavor, and at the same time, there's such a range of stocks available and aseptic packages or powdered broths or bouillon. So I used water as the main base and then worked on flavoring the water with the spices and herbs and the vegetables themselves. But I also list some stock, basic stock recipes. And an easy way for people to have that base flavor is just to save their vegetable clippings. And if you can't fill a stock pot in 1 day or 2 days, you could keep a bowl or a pot in the freezer and just add your clippings as you go. And then when you get about six to eight cups of vegetable trimmings, then you can prepare the stock yourself. And I explain how easy that is. And students in my classes really, that's one of the big tips they walk away with, to see how easy that is.
Yeah, it is easy. I don't like wasting food, and I live in an apartment, and I don't compost at this point in time.
Right.
Some people may not care about throwing away food or waste, but I don't like it. And the wonderful thing about soup is you can practically throw everything in it. You talk about your herbs that you can chop the stems in as well. They've got tons of flavor. Maybe the French wouldn't do that, but
they'll use herbs as well. I actually, interestingly enough, just had a Cordon Bleu graduate take my 10-day training, and so I was able to pick up on some things, and he approved of my stock creation method. So
good.
You could use a lot. There's a wide range of stocks that you can create.
Okay. Let's see. This happens from time to time where I have something on the tip of my tongue and then I swallow it. I forget it. Oh, okay. I just, I think my favorites are the Asian noodle soups, the Vietnamese noodle soups especially. And, you know, before I said I don't order soup in a restaurant, except there is an exception, and that is I found a few restaurants actually in San Jose, California, that make some wonderful noodle soups that I just love. And I just found a restaurant in Manhattan that made it to my specification, which is a place called Wild Ginger. There's a few of them in Manhattan. But still best to make it, I think, for yourself at home, and you have some great recipes in here to do that too.
Yeah, and the noodles are another way that you could change the flavor of the dishes. There's rice noodles and buckwheat noodles that you can use for to create different flavored noodle-based soups. And I also include a section on creamy vegan soups, and that's really, to me, where the vegan soups shine, because they really taste like they have dairy in them. And
right.
So there's numerous techniques that we use, like adding cashews or macadamia nuts, either raw or toasted, and blending that in to create a creaminess. You can also use plant-based milks like coconut milk or almond milk or soy milk to create this creaminess. And I would say pretty much every recipe in the creamy vegan soup section of the book, you would be really hard-pressed to tell that there was no dairy in it.
Oh, yeah, I know that. And it's just convincing the world that
preaching to the choir.
Yeah, really. No, I mean, I didn't mean to say that in a smug way or anything. It's just, yes, underline, I know that, and everyone else needs to know it, because this food is not only better for us, it's kinder and gentler on the planet. And, you know, people who think they can't live without milk and butter and cheese, well, you can. And, Mark, you're doing it for us right here in this one little book.
Well, I like that you mentioned that, because to me it does go beyond the food aspect to the implications of these food choices. And it is my real strong passion to show people that having a plant-based diet and lifestyle is not only amazing for their health, but also the benefit to the environment, and just to eliminate some of the more atrocious things that are going on right now in the forms of factory farming and just the kind of pollution and violence that's involved in the factory farming method, you can really create this incredible cuisine without sacrificing or compromising, and it has all those extra added benefits that you mentioned.
Yep. We just want to make it, we want to get rid of all the excuses. People have so many excuses. There's no room for excuses, not with all this great food out there.
Yeah, and it's just like a way of doing our part to create this, and a lot of people to create this kind of more harmonious existence. And a lot of people are aware of the benefits of plant-based cuisine and just are not sure on how to go about doing it. And so that's what I feel like my mission is to fill that gap of the how-to portion of it. So I have an online training through my website, and also I just travel internationally offering these longer immersions and write the cookbooks just to show people that if you've heard about plant-based cuisine and you've heard about the benefits but may not be sure how to start or what to do, like, I really like showing people how easy it is and how transformative it is for them to take these steps themselves.
Right on. So people can find you at veganfusion.com, right?
Definitely, yes. That's the website, and we do put out a newsletter where I'll send out some recipes and upcoming events and tours that I'm offering.
Okay, sounds delicious. And
cool.
It's good to hear that you're based a little closer to us now.
Yeah, I'm doing a training in New York in March and another training in Miami in October, so I'll be based on the East Coast now, so I'll be offering more events down here.
Okay, well, we're glad to have you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Mark. I love this new book.
Karen.
I'm a big soup fan, and I can't wait to dig in a little more to it.
Please let me know how you like it. Thank you.
I will.
Okay, take care.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, that was Mark Reinfeld, and all of his 30-Minute Vegan books are very useful, very informative, and very delicious. So there were a few things I wanted to talk about before we take a break and move on to my next guest. So there are a few things in the news I think are worth mentioning. Have you heard about the genetically modified purple tomatoes? Right. I just read about them, and there are so many things that just make me smile or make me mad. Guess what this one does to me? So it seems there was a British scientist who went to Canada to work on this purple tomato because in Great Britain they're not too genetically modified food friendly. And I didn't know that Canada was, but apparently they're working together in Ontario. New Energy Farms is putting out the purple tomato. And what's interesting about the purple tomato, okay, is it has been modified in order to create anthocyanin, an antioxidant, which has been shown in animal studies to help fight cancer. The interesting thing is this item is found in fruits like blueberries. But for some reason, they thought people might like it better in a purple tomato? Who doesn't like blueberries? This is something that I don't understand. No, but I do understand, because when you create a genetically modified food, you can patent it. And when you patent something, then you have the rights to it, and you can make a lot more money than from the simple foods that have been offered to us by nature. It's kind of hard to patent those things. And I would really love to see our governments support the production of really healthy foods so everybody could have lots of blueberries. Blueberries are kind of expensive, but they're really worth it. And I don't know any children who turn down blueberries or a lot of berries. They're always a very welcome, lovely, natural treat. Purple tomatoes, now I wouldn't mind a heritage version of tomatoes, you know, all of those funny shaped yellow and orange and all kind of purpley red tomatoes. Those are all great. But genetically modified, the thing about genetically modified foods is, number one, we don't know if they're safe. I'm not saying they're not safe. We just don't know. So let's say that they are. Let's say that there isn't a problem with technology by putting in these specific genes into from one plant into another. Let's say there's nothing wrong with that and we can do it well. What's wrong is that genetically modified foods encourage us to use all of the bad agricultural systems and processes, including using pesticides and herbicides, toxic chemicals that we put into the earth. And it also encourages monocropping. It also encourages large companies owning seeds and having us have to buy seeds. Now, the interesting thing about our culture these days is more and more we're specialized in everything we do. I mean, just think about it. In order to get our energy and our water, it's a great thing. We now are part of a big grid, and we all plug in and get our electricity. Sure, we pay for it month to month, but it's a hell of a lot easier than trying to figure out ways to provide our own energy so that we can heat our homes and run our appliances and use our phones, right? And it's great that we are able to get water from our faucets and use pretty much as we need. Now, there's a whole other subject about whether that water is good to use, and I prefer to distill my water and filter my water, but it's great to be able to have access to it. And these are the things that we benefit from technology and living in community. But in order to do that, we need to have certain companies manage these things, and we pay for that service. And it looks like a certain few number of corporations want to do that with our food, where they control the seeds, where they control our food supply. And I love the conveniences and benefits I get from certain sorts of technology and improvement. I'm uncomfortable with my food supply being controlled. Now, if I could, I really wish I could grow my own food, and I think more and more of us should be finding ways to do that, especially because as things become more complex and energy becomes more expensive, being able to access food from local areas is, I think, going to be what's going to be necessary in the long term. And thinking about if there was some sort of crisis of one sort or another and things shut down, where would our food be coming from? I don't like to create these gloom and doom pictures, but it is something to think about. And when I think about genetically modified food, I think about companies trying to control our food supply, and that makes me uncomfortable. So I'm not excited to hear about purple tomatoes, but if you try one, let me know what you think. How about that? And we were talking about soup today with Mark Reinfeld. I want to let you know I just posted on my Responsible Eating and Living website a new Tom Kha soup. That's a Thai coconut-based soup. It's one of these soups that I love, love, love. And the challenging thing is when you go to most Thai restaurants, even if you ask for the food to be vegetarian, they usually slip in a little fish sauce into it because most of them don't equate fish to not being vegetarian. And the only real way to get it the way you like it is to make it, which is something I did the other day and just posted the recipe. And I'm really excited because it's one of my favorite soups, and it's great to be able to make it at home. And then another thing I wanted to encourage or just think about. We're a very internet-based society today, and I know myself, I love to buy most things online, and I'm limiting more and more my face-to-face community interaction with real people. Now, occasionally, I have to go to the post office, although I try to avoid it at all costs. And did you know that postage just went up again? It's now 49 cents to mail a letter. and occasionally, I have to go into my banks, even though I try to do most of my banking online. But when I talk to an individual face-to-face, sometimes I'm really surprised. And I've had a few of these experiences recently where one of the bankers asked about my business. I told them about responsible eating and living. They were interested, and that opens up a whole dialogue, and I start giving my plant food lecture, and more often than not, the people are receptive. I learn about how little people know about food, which is always surprising to me, and I'm always happy to give them information. My point is, we were taught as kids not to talk to strangers. I think as adults, we can kind of intuit who the strangers are that are safe to talk to. But it's really good to open up to people and let them know about plant foods any way we can, certainly sharing that information with friends and family. I was in a food store a few weeks ago, and a woman just started asking me about apple juice. And with the door open, I managed to turn her attention away from apple juice and over to the dark leafy green section in the produce section, telling her how important those greens are. Right. Anyway, if you have any questions or concerns about food, please email me at info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org, and we can have a conversation. Right now, I'm going to finish my green juice. We'll take a little break and be back with Jonathan Balcom. We're going to be talking about the inner lives of animals. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back. It is January 28th, 2014. And this is our second part of the program today. And how are you doing? I didn't ask you that earlier. I wish you would let me know. By doing that, you can email me at info@realmeals.org. I love to hear from you. I love to hear your comments and your questions. I learned so much. And like I was talking earlier about community, well, if we can't meet face-to-face, we can certainly meet online and have a conversation. I like to think that we are not really alone on this planet. We are not really alone. We are all part of some same big, mysterious something, energy, universe. And it's important that we realize that. We all breathe the same air and are living on the same earth. There's a lot to that, and we tend to kind of think within our own little bodies, and there's a lot more to what's going on. I want to bring on my next guest, Jonathan Balcom. He is an animal behavior expert and a passionate advocate for animals and their living spaces. He was born in England and raised in Canada and New Zealand. He showed an early interest in animals. His favorite place to visit at age 3 was the London Zoo, and by 6 he was gazing at insects in the backyard. He studied biology at York University and Carleton University in Canada before getting a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior, from the University of Tennessee, where he studied vocal recognition and mother-pup reunion behavior in the Mexican free-tailed bat. He has published over 50 journal articles and book chapters ranging from turtle nesting behavior to the ethics of animal dissection. His 2006 book, Pleasurable Kingdom, is the first in-depth examination of animals' capacity to enjoy life. His subsequent book, Second Nature and the Exultant Ark, continue to present animals in a new light and presage a revolution in the human-animal relationship. He's currently writing a book on the inner lives of fishes. A popular speaker, he has given invited presentations on 6 continents. The penguins are still waiting for him to visit Antarctica. All right. Welcome to It's All About Food, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Hi. So have we gotten the phone technology all worked out there?
Well, I'm on the phone now. The Skype didn't work for some reason. I'll have to figure that out next time, but
I
can hear you.
Okay, and currently you're the executive director of the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy in Washington.
Yeah, yes. I'm sort of transferring into that position. There's some flux going on right now, but yes, that is a new role for me.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad you're in it. Okay. So you do some really interesting work, something that not a lot of people pay attention to, and we certainly should be. So let's start in the very beginning. You say that at the age of three, you loved the London Zoo. How do you feel about zoos today, Jonathan?
Yeah, mixed. Sadly, zoos are one of the few places some urban people get to see animals, but really, are they seeing the real animal? I mean, a tiger in a zoo, for instance, is not a tiger. I mean, it's physically that animal. It's got the genetics of a tiger, but it doesn't do anything like a tiger, doesn't behave like a tiger. So an animal like that, large predators, would be an example of a group of animals that are totally unsuited to being in any kind of captive situation. And I think that applies to, I would say, the majority of animals kept in zoos today, and there's obviously a preference for the charismatic megavertebrates, the larger ones, which ironically are the ones that shouldn't be there because they need more space to live. So I'm very troubled by zoos, but of course I wasn't thinking about any of those things when I was a little kid going to the London Zoo.
Yeah, I used to enjoy going to the Bronx Zoo when I was a kid in New York. Yeah. And are you familiar with Martin Rowe's book, The Polar Bear in the Zoo?
I know of it. I haven't read it yet. I like Martin and his work.
Yeah. Well, what it talked about is framing and how we perceive things in a frame of reference. And I think what you're doing is helping us see things beyond the frame and think outside of the box, or whatever cliches we want to use. And in understanding animals to the best of our feeble ability, it might help us understand ourselves and the world around us.
Well, I'm encouraged that more and more scientists are also thinking outside of the box. Just one example, Vladimir Dinets, he's a Russian national. He's at the University of Tennessee now. He just got his PhD last year. And such are his discoveries about crocodile behavior that I believe he's published 12 or 13 scientific papers on his findings from his PhD research just in the last year or two. I'm delighted to say he's coming to speak at a conference we're organizing for in Washington, D.C. in March. I hope maybe we can come back to that, a conference on animal thinking and emotion. And he's going to be presenting his latest findings on crocodile behavior, cognition, maybe even emotion, meaning not suggesting they don't have emotions, but whether he's talking about that. But a recent discovery of his is that crocodiles use tools. That they
We're in trouble.
Yes. Certainly if you're a heron, you're maybe in trouble, because what they do is they carry twigs on their heads, and then they only do this during the time when herons and egrets are breeding, so it's time-sensitive and location-sensitive, and they bring these sticks and float them below the rookeries of these nests. And the nesting herons, well, you can guess what they use to build their nests out of, and there's a real premium on sticks at that time of year. The heron comes down to get the stick, and, you know, you can figure out the rest of the story. So quite remarkable behavior from an animal that is so often dismissed as a cold-blooded, unthinking automaton reptile.
Yes, hello, humans. We have some competition with tool use. I know humans thought that we were special in that area, and we keep coming to find out more and more that other species are using tools too.
Well, I think what we could say is, you know, we are special
we are special.
Unique, but we're certainly not unique in that we use tools and other animals use and manufacture tools, and it's a good example of a long list of things that we did used to think were unique to humans that we've had to strike a lot of those things off the list. But I think, you know, we do tend to be intellicentric. We love to focus on animal intelligence and cognition, and because we feel like we're so very smart. But animals are good at what they need to be good at. We all evolve in different pathways, ways that suit our way of living. And I think it's really short-sighted of us to demean or reduce animals because they may not function cognitively in the particular ways that we do.
I have a copy of your book, Pleasurable Kingdom. It's actually a signed copy. I was fortunate to receive it when I was at the PCRM Gala in 2007 in Washington. I think they gave it to all the attendees there.
They did. That was a fun event.
Were you there?
I was.
Oh, okay. I was there, too.
I was a peon doing work in the background.
Oh, well, it was an interesting time for me because I was in between major surgeries for advanced ovarian cancer, a subject we can talk about at another time. And I thought I was done, but I wasn't done, and I was really uncomfortable during that event. And I was so looking forward to it and looked for all the ways I possibly could to seek pleasure that evening in order to focus on the pleasure and not on the pain. And you talked a bit about pleasure and pain in your Pleasurable Kingdom book with respect to animals.
Yes, just a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. Unfortunately, it's a funny thing, the way we focus our understanding in the scientific realm. We'll do experiments on animals and inflict pain on them in order to see different things, but we don't really want to acknowledge that either they feel pain or that they feel pleasure.
It's a very strange imbalance that we've had, with a great deal of attention and time and effort and research paid to the study of pain. There are some 25-odd journals published today, scholarly journals, that actually have the word pain in the title of the journal. These journals are dedicated to the study and understanding of pain. Now, on one level, it's understandable because pain is an urgent issue. It's a very major issue that, well, you know, anyone who's suffering from it, pretty much everyone would want it relieved. But isn't it interesting that there are no journals on pleasure, and yet pleasure plays such an important central role in our lives and our motivations and the decisions we make on a day-to-day basis, what we eat, what we wear, the kind of work we do, where we go for entertainment, etc. And when I thought about animal pleasure, I was just stunned to realize that there really had been so little attention to it. I spent 10 years studying biology at three different universities, and I don't recall a single occasion where anything was discussed about animal pleasure, about animals' capacity to derive pleasure. I mean, scientists have talked about reward and that sort of thing in a kind of an evolutionary context, but even that is a fairly little thought about phenomenon. But really, pleasure in that kind of conscious awareness sense where you seek out good feelings, really, we'd kind of missed the boat on that. So I was very inspired to delve into that subject, and it's been a really rewarding and, ironically, interestingly, a rewarding subject to pursue.
I loved hearing about the crocodiles and the twigs. Do you have some favorite examples of animals seeking pleasure and experiencing pleasure?
Yeah, from a sort of a rigorous scientific perspective, I think the work of Jaak Panksepp is among the best with rats. He also will be speaking at our conference. He noticed that rats would, you know, when they're young especially, they play, they wrestle, they flip each other over, they tickle each other in the belly, and they various sort of behaviors. And when you put a bat detector next to them, you notice that these ultrasonic chirp sounds. They're at 50 kilohertz, a specific frequency. And rats also are known, now that we have equipment that we can detect this stuff, they're known to make sounds at about 22 kilohertz, which is sort of negative. So if they're chirping at 22 kilohertz, they're probably not very happy about what's going on. It may be associated with pain or distress. Mm. Whereas if they're chirping up in the 50 kilohertz range, essentially it's the rat's way of saying, wow, this is delightful, I'm really enjoying this. And when they tickle each other and play, they do this. He then decided, let's measure this. So they set up the bat detectors, and then they had rats in two groups. One group was petted each day at a certain time on the neck and then put back in their enclosure, and then the other group were flipped on their backs and tickled. And they found at the end of a few days of that, the rats who had been petted on the neck would come to the hand, so they appeared to like that. But rats who had been tickled ran to the hand four times as quickly and made seven times as many of these high-pitched chirps. So sort of a very quantitative study. He and his team have since done a number of other studies to sort of present more information about what's going on. But the take-home message is that they're not just doing something that may be adaptive, and there's adaptive basis for play behavior, but they're enjoying it. It's fun for them. It feels good. And I think, you know, we can all relate to that. We know what it's like to play and tickle when we're kids or when we're grown-ups.
I don't like being tickled.
Yeah, and it's...
I don't like being tickled.
Well, no, most people don't. Tickling is sort of aggressive and unpleasant, but depending on the context and how it's done, In any event, for all indications are that these rats are having a blast when they do this.
Yeah. It's just incredible how little we see and how framed in we are by our own experiences, how so many of us just refuse to see or acknowledge what's going on around us. Unfortunately, with technology and some new tools, we can perceive some of the things that we don't even have the senses for.
Yeah, well, technology does allow us to, that's right, to advance some of our understanding. I mean, PET scans and fMRIs, functional MRIs, where you can actually see a brain in action. Another speaker at our conference, Greg Burns, down at Emory University, they have trained domestic dogs who are very malleable and trainable. They respond to us. You can train them to sit still. And so they have them sitting still, fully awake in an fMRI machine, looking out, you know, sitting comfortably, and getting treats in return for the right behavior. And they then present them with pictures or with stimuli, and they see how their brains respond. And they find, lo and behold, they're finding that their brains respond emotionally. The emotional lighting up of their brain mirrors those of the human brain in terms of responses to particular emotive stimuli, stimuli that you would expect to cause an emotional response. I'm looking forward to learning more about that when he comes and speaks at our meeting.
Yeah, what can you give us more detail on that meeting?
Yes, it's called the Science of Animal Thinking and Emotion, and it's on March 17th to 18th here in Washington, D.C. at Gallaudet University. And if people go online and just, well, I guess I should probably give you a URL before the end of the presentation, and then they can go. But it's presented by the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy. So if people Google the HSISP, for short, and then conference in Washington, D.C., I mean, it's bound to come up, animal thinking and emotion. Any of those terms will bring up the page where people can get more information, and if they wish, they can register.
Okay, great. Well, you can send me a link later after the program, and I'll include it in the post for this program.
Okay.
Yeah, great. And, okay, what I want to know is, you're talking about some of this wonderful work that's going on. Who's funding it? Are there particular organizations or universities that fund this sort of information? And I'll tell you what I'm trying to get at, because usually the funding only comes from organizations that want to profit from things. Rarely do we see things just from the joy of learning something.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question, and I can tell you, going back to the rat example, Jaak Panksepp, I've talked to him about this research, and he was unable to get any funding for that. He tried and tried because it was outside the comfort zone of science and funding. It's like, well, what do you mean pleasure in rats? I mean, you know, there was a lot of skepticism and disbelief that there would even be such a phenomenon. And so really what that says is that what is revealed by science has to go through a filter, and the filter can really skew what you find out. I mean, there's just not funding for some of the most interesting stuff from my perspective, animal emotion and that sort of thing. I mean, and that's changing. That's getting back to the change we're seeing, is because as you get an accumulation of information that animals are doing stuff that we used to think they didn't do, then there's more interest. So I'm hopeful that the funding for that sort of study will be growing, but really it is challenging for scientists who want to really think outside the box.
Okay, well, what I'm thinking, one of my motives is to get people to understand about animals and how incredible they are and how intelligent they are, in order so that people don't exploit them and don't eat them, because there's so much more to them than using them as food. But when I think about the science that would go on that would be supported, I think it would probably be from universities or companies that want to learn how to manipulate animals even more so that they can have them happily walk up the plank to slaughter or whatever.
Well, not all the research is of that ilk. I mean, you know, this guy Dinitz, who's been doing the crocodile stuff, the neuroimaging of the dog brain, I mean, that's I suppose in the grant proposal there is some language in there to the effect of how this might be applied. But that even then, it might be to improve the human-companion-animal relationship or something like that. I mean, it's not always with a commercial bent. And so I'm encouraged to see that, you know, there is a fair amount of research that's exploratory and doesn't have to be justified by someone making a profit.
Chicken's, I think, the most popular meat these days, and it's on the rise as red meats go down. I think somewhere along the last few decades, people got the message that red meat isn't so healthy, but then they got the message that chicken's a better choice.
Yeah, but even then, in the U.S., chicken consumption is dropping. The USDA itself estimated that 500 million fewer chickens would be consumed by Americans in 2013 than in the last few years before leaving.
Well, that's good news. We just have to get that message to China.
Yes, indeed. Globally, we're not going the right direction.
Right.
Part of the problem with that is more humans, more mouths to feed, and I write about that in my book, Second Nature.
We're the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real elephant in the room, human overpopulation, and that's just not being addressed by politicians anywhere.
Yeah, and I was reading something this past week. It was either the New York Times or the New Yorker. Those are really the only two things that I read other than books. But there was some study about humanity around the world, and I mean, this isn't new information, but the more we educate different populations and as women become educated and more useful in society, the population goes down because the families decide to have less children and they don't need as many because they're not dying of hygiene issues or malnutrition or whatever. And that's really what we need to do, provide more education, and populations naturally go down.
Yes, and it's not anti-human to say that. I mean, I think that may be why politicians don't get on that horse. Or so.
More is not better.
No, and of course, if coming back to animals, I mean, if the more humans there are, the less space there is for animals to live, and that's also a direct impact we have. I mean, habitat loss, biodiversity loss, and that's a direct result of more and more humans living on the earth.
And we need other species on this planet, not just humans.
Yeah, even that's, you know, that's an anthropocentric thing to say, but it's a reality. You know, if it's pro-human to want biodiversity. It's not anti-human to want us to curb our numbers and to make more space for other animals to live and other organisms to grow.
Yeah, we don't acknowledge that enough, and I think scientifically we're just learning the importance of certain bacteria, for example, and bacteria in the soil and bacteria in our gut. And there's a lot of life out there that we can't live without.
Yep, it's true.
Okay. Let's see. We just have a couple of minutes left. And I brought up the chicken thing because I wondered if you had any good chicken stories or bird stories, because birds are so incredible and so kind and so intelligent, and we often don't give them.
I often talk about chickens, and they're fun to talk about. I mean, I was making some notes before our conversation. Just a couple of really recent things in the news. An example of tool use in crows and herons. They will use crumbs, drop them on the water to lure fishes in and catch the fish. It's interesting on two levels. One is tool use. Because using their food as tools, but also restraint, delayed gratification, because the crow, and for that matter, the heron, could just eat the bread or the crumbs right away. I mean, herons don't typically eat bread, but crows would, and yet they're planning ahead. They're going to forego the food that I have now immediately, because I can use it to get a bigger prize. But I want to add something about fish, because I'm writing a book about fishes now, and the fish are turning the tables. There's some examples of fishes that actually catch birds in midair. Tigerfish in Africa were recently filmed and documented. You can see a rather grainy YouTube video of a tigerfish swimming, must have swum very rapidly underwater, and leaps out and grabs a flying swallow from behind in the air, which is pretty amazing physical coordination, and I would say probably planning. And then catfish in a lake in France for some years now have been swimming into the shallows and grabbing pigeons who are coming in to drink in the shallows. The pigeons are a bit nonchalant, and they shouldn't be, because there's about a 28% mortality rate when the fish grabs the pigeon.
We don't think about it that way, the fish grabbing the bird.
We generally don't think of it that way, but it cuts both ways, and one of the reasons I'm writing a book on fishes is because they're, well, A, extremely exploited by humans in huge numbers, and B, very misunderstood. There's some great science on fish cognition that's now coming out showing that fishes have complex social lives, Machiavellian dynamics.
Wow, Jonathan, great. I wish we could talk a lot more about it. This is a subject that deserves a lot more time, but we're at the end of the program. So thank you so much for joining me, and I hope to meet you in person real soon.
Having me.
And thank you again.
Okay, till next time. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That's the end of the show, and have a delicious week. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been another It's All About Food. Bye-bye.